Good evening, everybody. Welcome back to the Marriage Fitness Plug-In Program with Mort Fertel. This is Mort Fertel, and this is your once-a-month Q&A teleconference. Welcome back to those of you that have been in the program for months and in some cases even years, and a special welcome to those of you that are new to the Marriage Fitness Plugged-In Program. For those of you that are new, this Q&A teleconference, in terms of its format, will be no surprise to you. It works pretty much the same as the Q&A teleconference from your previous Marriage Fitness Program. That is, just a couple of quick reminders. If you have a question, press star 6. That'll queue you up for a question. If I do choose you to ask your question, please remember the all-important rule that saves us a lot of time and allows us to be as efficient as possible with all of our time, and that is to please begin with your question, then allow me to probe you for the background information that I feel I need in order to answer your question. There were a number of people who emailed questions in advance. Some of them I chose to handle tonight. I'm going to start with couple of them, and then we'll have two more to get to between your live questions. So let's begin. You're all veterans. No sense in wasting time with announcements. Let's get to as many people as we can. So here we go. I have to put my glasses on. I'm getting a little older, guys. Okay. How do you handle your husband working with the woman that he had the emotional affair with? I know that he has cut all ties with her. He constructed an email asking her not to have any conversations or contact with him unless it is work-related. They are both physicians, and they literally have to work together. I might add that my husband did ask the scheduler not to put him at one of the satellite hospitals where they are usually only two of them on staff. I do want to thank you for saving us so far. We are not perfect by any means and still have a meltdown every once in a while, but I started listening to you on Thanksgiving Eve. You saved us. If it has not been for those teleconferences, I would have not let him come back home. I had asked him to leave for a while because he would not tell me why he felt the need to have a texting relationship with this, quote, friend. Anyway, having a difficult time when he has to work with her, I imagine looks between them, unspoken words. I do not know how to deal with this. Thank you for your time, Teresa. Okay. Excellent question, Teresa. And I assume it sounds like you've made tremendous progress, that your husband's done a lot to try to sever ties with this mistress, so to speak. I say so to speak because it sounds like it was emotional and not physical. It sounds like, you know, you've made good progress. And that your husband's on board with this effort. So I'm going to answer your question, assuming that your husband is listening as well, or at least is open to my answer. Not that it would change that much if he wasn't, but it just sounds like that's the case. So, look, I admire and I commend both of you for the progress you've made, and in particular for the efforts you made to, quote, cut ties with her, constructing an email asking her not to have any conversations or contact with him unless it's work-related, contacting the scheduler and asking him not to put him at one of the satellite hospitals where the two of them would be on staff together. I mean, you gave a number of examples where you're trying, you and or your husband are trying to sever all contact and make it such that there's no risk of them having anything to do with each other. And you mean well. Your husband means well. You're on the right track. You've taken good steps. I commend you for that. However, it gives me no pleasure to tell you this. And I know it's going to be highly inconvenient advice, but the fact of the matter is you can have all the best intentions in the world, and you can try to jump through all of these hoops with the scheduler and all the other efforts that you and your husband are making. And again, it's great. I commend you for it. But it's only going to take you so far. And you're going to have to rebuild, your husband's going to have to rebuild the trust here. And you're going to have to get to the point where you feel safe and secure in your relationship in order for it to be a great marriage, in order for you to feel safe, in order for there to be trust, in order for you to not just feel like you're making progress and in the process of healing and reconciliation, but really where you want to be ultimately at some point is where you feel we made it. Not we made it like we're done, we can relax, and we don't have to, you know, employ these principles and practices anymore. I hope one of the things you've all learned is that, you know, these are not tricks or techniques or things that I'm teaching you just for this time in your life. These are principles and practices that are that I am teaching as a matter of lifestyle. I think you can tell, I hope you can tell, people have told me that they can tell, that this is not just something that I teach. This is not something that I, you know, simply learned in school. This is not just simply a profession. I live this. I've been living this for years, and I plan to live it for the rest of my life. And you should plan to live it for the rest of your life. Well, that was definitely a tangent. How did I get on that? right. So it's great that you're making progress, but eventually you want to get to the point where, you know, where you've really made it. Again, not made it in the sense that you can now relax, but made it in the sense that, like, we're no longer in that painful, difficult, anxiety-ridden period of our life. We made it out of there, and we have a healthy, happy, normal marriage. Okay, there might be a period of our marriage, might be a part of our marital history that wasn't happy, healthy, and normal. But again, we pulled ourselves out of that. We rebuilt the trust. I feel safe. And we have a great marriage and a great relationship. That's where you want to get to. You will not get there as long as your husband keeps working with this woman. I'm sorry for saying it so black and white, but I can see you and your husband are a little lost in the gray. In other words, you mean well, you have the best of intentions, you've made good progress. You either haven't heard me say what I'm saying now, or more likely, you have heard me say it, and you're looking for a workaround. You're looking for an alternative way. You're going to try to do it a little differently. Okay, I mean, you know, it's your life. And again, I commend you for the progress and for your effort and for your intentions. And if you should happen to find a way to get to that place that I'm talking about while your husband is still working, please send me an email or let me know how you did it, because I've got, you know, tens of thousands of other people that would like to know and that I could teach it to. But I don't think it's going to happen. I've been doing this a long time, and that's, you know, my job is just to give it to you straight. It's not going to happen. And you say here, I quote, where is it? They are both physicians, and they literally have to work together. Now, this is just an email. It's a couple of hundred words, maybe. And, you know, I don't know who you are, and we haven't met and had private sessions or a house call or anything, not that I know of, anyway. And so, you know, I suppose I'm willing to be open-minded and say that I may not have all the information, and I suppose that it's remotely possible that that statement is true, but I doubt it. And I would challenge you and your husband, what do you mean by that? That you literally have to work together? I don't know what that means. I mean, really? Your husband's not able to get another job somewhere else? At another hospital? In another city? Or your husband's not able to maybe take some time off while you work? Now, I realize this may be far from ideal from a career or financial perspective, but I'm not giving you career or financial advice. If you want that, you'll have to go somewhere else. And not only am I not going to give it to you, but I'm going to preach to you that you should prioritize your marriage above your career and your money, And if making this move, cutting these ties, requires you to make a career or financial compromise, I beg you, do it. Do it. It'll be worth it. And so nobody has to work anywhere. If your husband's a physician, I don't know if you work, the chances are good that, you know, he's employable somehow, somewhere. And even if he's not employable for, you know, for a number of months, generally doctors make a decent living. That generally means that they have money saved. So I doubt you're the kind of family living paycheck by paycheck. And you know, maybe you'll have to downsize. Maybe you'll have to make some lifestyle changes. But isn't it worth it? Otherwise, I'm really concerned for you that your husband will remain a doctor in that hospital. You'll continue to have all, you know, the same income and the lifestyle, and he'll continue to have a prosperous career. But you'll be in this program forever, every month emailing me questions like this because you're looking for some workaround that doesn't exist. So bite the bullet. Accept the truth, the reality of the situation. And don't box yourself into a corner with words like they are both physicians and they literally have to work together. There must be options. Okay, excellent question. Thank you very much. I'm 7 months into the program. My husband now says he is sorry for the situation and the hurt to me. He feels terrible. He also now apologizes as soon as he is obstinate or recoils. Last week he said he had been selfish, and he couldn't believe how he had treated me. He now doesn't want to leave. However, I feel empty as he's trying harder to keep things separate and not want me. Such charges make him angry. Am I making any progress? It sounds like you're making progress. I'm not sure why I picked this email, to be honest. I don't know that I have anything brilliant or insightful to say. Maybe I just wanted to, just answer your question. Simple one. You know, it sounds like you're making progress. You know, it's quite a thing for a previous obstinate spouse to admit that he's been selfish and to have remorse about how he previously treated you. I mean, that alone represents tremendous progress. And by the way, there's two different things here that you've told me in that one idea. You told me that he feels that way. That alone is amazing. But you told me something else. He said it. That's a whole different level. As I've explained to many of you in other parts of the program, you know, what the obstinate spouse says is often not reflective of what's really going on for them. In other words, to tie this into your question here, In a lot of instances, the obstinate spouse is feeling what you just described, but they won't say it. They won't let you know that that's what they're thinking and feeling. They're far, far from expressing that kind of remorse. And when somebody does that, I mean, that is a clear indication that you have reached them, that you've made great progress, that they're willing to be vulnerable with you. So congratulations on that. Okay, let's go on. Go to the live phones.
Hello?
Yes, sir.
Yes, my name is Kyle.
Okay, Kyle, how are you tonight?
Not too bad. And my question is there any way to reboot your obstinate spouse? Been in the Lone Ranger program probably 2 years, made a lot of progress.
What does that mean, reboot?
Restart it. I made a lot of progress with her in the first year, and since then it's just been shutting me out, withdrawing.
What changed, do you think?
She realized she was having a good time. The big change was we went out on a date night and we had a great time. She laughed. And then the next day she was just withdrawn into herself. She was just as cold as an ice cube.
So what you're saying that what changed was something in that one night that you had a good time?
Yeah, there was a general build-up to, you know, she's being more open and going out. And then after that, well, not that one date, but that after that date, it's just been a general decline.
What happened on that date that resulted in that decline?
We just talked about old times and things we had done and people we had known, and she laughed, like, from the bottom of her belly, like, three or four times on some jokes.
You're not answering the question, though. You're actually making the question more compelling.
What's the question?
She laughed from her belly. That wouldn't normally be a reason for somebody to disconnect and for things to go in the opposite direction. That sounds like an amazing evening. I feel like I'm missing something. I'm trying to understand what the turning point was that resulted in her disconnecting from you and distancing herself. What occurred on that? Do you have any idea what happened on that night?
No, other than she had a good time. That's my dilemma.
Well, but didn't she have a good time? You described that evening as the culmination of a year's worth of efforts and progress, correct?
Yes, it was the best date of the year by far.
So presumably it might have been the best, but it sounds like there were many others and that many of those others were quite positive as well.
Correct.
I don't know. I don't have an answer, but what I would suggest is that you ask her if you haven't already. Just simply, I mean, it sounds like you've made enough progress that you could simply ask her. Maybe from your perspective, this was this wonderful, you know, belly laughing evening. I wonder if something happened that you missed, that for some reason was off your radar, that hurt her, offended her, gave her reason to pause, to be scared. I don't know. But my guess is that if you've been in the program this long and made as much progress as you described, that you've built up enough goodwill that you've earned the right to just simply ask and see what comes out of that. I don't know what will come out of it. It might be a very quick conversation. Nothing comes out of it, and you'll be back asking the same question again. That's okay. Still, I think simply asking is the first step, and you might get some insight from her, at least more than you're getting from me now, I admit, because I don't know. What you describe sounds like a mystery.
Hello.
Hi there.
Hi. Well, my question is...
Sorry, what's your name?
My name is Julie.
Julie.
And
okay, Julie.
I've been in the program probably since November. My husband left a year ago this week. I mean, a year ago, end of March last year. And really, we've had little contact. I mean, we talk some. He is having an emotional affair with someone, supposedly not physical. He lives in the basement duplex of her home. He won't answer the phone very often for me. He won't listen to messages. He doesn't respond to texts. He doesn't open
Julie,
my mail.
One second, Julie. Let's start with your question. What's your question?
Okay. So my question is, this week he's told me that he does have papers ready for me to sign for a divorce, and I'm just wondering if there's anything more I can be doing. I've asked him to, you know, let's give it a shot. I mean, it's why just throw it all away without giving it a real try? And
well, when you say,
not,
is there anything more you can be doing, I mean, I don't know if that's a question I'm going to be able to answer on this Q&A teleconference tonight.
Okay.
What you should be doing is everything that I've described in the many, many pages and many, many hours of audios that you have read and listened to in both the plugged-in program and the previous program. Now, what of those things you are not doing that you should be doing, that I won't be able to diagnose, you know, in a few minutes. That would take a long time.
I think.
But what you might do that might benefit you is you might comb through all those materials again and ask yourself, what am I missing? You know, a lot of times people go through the materials, they learn it, but they don't do it.
Mm-hmm.
That's not useful. You know, this is not a training program. This is a this is a marriage program. You have to do it for it to really be
mm-hmm.
useful.
With the lack of him being, he's not willing, like I've said, let's go out to lunch, or let, you know, and he won't do that. He doesn't open the mail.
Let's not waste time talking about what he won't do. I don't think that's going to be useful, because it can be very destructive. Because usually this is not an accusation, I'm just trying to be helpful, and of course we don't have a lot of time, but usually what I find when I do have more time with people is that the people that are focused on listing all of the things that he or she won't do, they're using that as an excuse to not do the things that they can do. And that's not helpful. I know there's a list of things that he won't do. That's always the case. But the question is, what can you do? And there are certain things that you can always do. Maybe he won't go out to lunch with you, but that doesn't mean that you can't see him. Maybe he won't reciprocate, give anything to you, but that doesn't mean that you can't give something to him.
Right. And I believe that I've done everything. You know, I've done a lot of the things, and maybe you're right that there's something I'm missing, but I guess the last time I had seen him, and he won't answer the door if I go to his place, and he won't come over. I mean, that's just really, he's got a wall. But when I do see him, like he had to take me to pick up a vehicle that had been repaired, and I would do a touch charge, or, you know, and then it resulted in like 10 days of him not speaking to me and him saying that he's got the divorce papers ready. And he really, you know, he actually said that he feels like I keep trying to make an effort to get him back, and so he shuts down.
Yeah, but again, I can't help, but I know you're just sharing with me your situation, hoping that I can be helpful, but I can't help but feel that what you're sharing with me is reflective of certain maybe things that need to be improved in your approach. For example, what you just shared with me indicates to me that you're over-concerned about your husband's responses to your efforts. As I mentioned in the last question, an obstinate spouse's response is a terrible indication as to how you're doing or the impact that you are having. And so, you know, he shuts down for 10 days. Let me let you in my head, okay? The way I process that piece of information is, so what? Really. I mean, it's almost completely irrelevant. The only way in which it is slightly relevant, and this itself, on the one hand, might be insightful to you. On the other hand, it itself is a slight violation of what I teach. The only way it might be slightly helpful is that it indicates that you reached him. Because what is he distancing himself from? Why is he reacting to that at all? The answer is because he feels you coming closer. He feels you tugging on his heart. He feels you tugging on his conscience. He feels you ruining his story. And so, I mean, I've mentioned this to all of you many times before, but I know it's hard to, you know, there's the longest distance between two parts of the body is not between the head and the toe. It's between the head and the heart. Meaning it's one thing to actually understand something, it's a whole other thing to really internalize it and to live it and breathe it. So, you know, you know, I've mentioned many times before that, you know, an obstinate spouse is going to try to derail you from your positive efforts. And his negative reaction to your efforts is not so much indicative of what he might be thinking or feeling as much as it is clearly indicative of his agenda. And so don't be careful. Don't be derailed. Certainly don't calibrate your actions based on your obstinate spouse's response. That provides him with leadership. That provides him or her with the controls in the marriage. And when you're dealing with an obstinate spouse, you know, they're out of control. They're off the rails. Your marriage is desperate for leadership, and the last place you want to get it from is an obstinate spouse who's having an affair, trying to exit the marriage, filing for divorce, or whatever the case may be. Dear Mort, should I set foot in my wife's residence? She moved in with her parents a year ago, and she's moving into an apartment next week. I don't wish to give any credence to this place, but the majority of our face-to-face interactions happen where she lives. Thank you for your consideration. You are doing great work, and your program has changed my life. Regards, Andrew. So this is an interesting question. I really have to answer it twice because it looks like her current residence is her parents' home. So I wouldn't actually, you know, for purpose of answering this question, I wouldn't consider that her residence. I would consider that her parents' residence. Those are your in-laws. And so my answer to the question would be sure. Why not? You've been to your in-laws' home many times, and you should continue to maintain your relationship with your in-laws. In fact, it's a good idea in situations like this to even try to build your relationship with your in-laws. And it's just a bonus, like a huge bonus, that your wife is there, and that when you're there, you have the opportunity to see your wife, interact with your wife, and with your in-laws. So there is no problem. In fact, I would encourage you to take the opportunity to interact with your wife there. However, if, God forbid, she were to move into her own residence, that's a different ballgame. And using your term, I would not set foot in a separate residence that she has established for herself. That residence will be, if it happens, your enemy. It is a physical representation of, you know, in of the separation, of a certain divisiveness. It's her attempt to establish a new life, and you don't want to help her with that at all. And by going there, by visiting her there, by having a meal there, by having a drink there, by bringing a plant there, all of that is validating and giving credence to that separate residence. And you don't want to do that. In your mind, in your reality, and your vision is that she doesn't have a separate residence. You know, her residence, her home, is with you. At the marital home, at your home. You know, this is why when people do move out, it drives me nuts when other professionals, you know, get in the way of me trying to help somebody save a marriage, and they give people stupid advice like set up borders and boundaries, make sure they call first, lock the door, change the locks, don't give them a key, you know, all this crazy stuff. No. What do you mean? We're not trying to erect borders and boundaries. We're not trying to create space. We're trying to break down the borders and boundaries, and we're trying to create a connection. So it's their home. They're the ones that is going to be promoting this idea that it's no longer their home. You have to be promoting the idea that it is their home, that there is one home, and they belong here. They don't have to ask to come over. They don't have to knock before they come in. This is your home. You're always welcome, and I always expect you here. Okay. Let's go on.
Hello, Mort. How are you on this fine spring evening?
Thank God I'm doing well. Who do I have the pleasure of speaking with?
This is Brad, thank you.
Brad, good evening.
Well, my wife and I will be separated close to a year in April, the middle of April, which is when she moved out. Since then, she has moved to Florida. In the past Q&A with you and I, you asked me to go down there or move down there, which I can't do because I do live on a check, a weekly check that's gone as soon as I get it, so to speak. In the meantime, I've been sending her gifts on a weekly basis, which is kind of difficult because it's all through Amazon and things like that. So sometimes she gets two gifts in 1 week. I've continued to send her voice emails because that's the only contact I have with her. So I guess I don't know what to do. I guess, well, back to the emails. I keep it pretty basic. I just kind of tell her what's going on around here with my job and family and things like that. I do ask her questions about bills that may come up.
So I keep it pretty basic.
I don't know what to do at this point because I don't even.
Well, let me give you one piece of advice. Again, this is a Q&A teleconference, and I can't get into the whole depth of your situation, but you did mention one thing that I can quickly and easily advise you on, and that is don't email your wife anymore. If she won't pick up the phone and you don't have the opportunity to speak to her, then leave her a voicemail if you can. If you can't, then record a voicemail on your computer or on your phone or whatever, and then send it as an attachment in an email. Don't write anything in the email. Digital communication is no good. Texting, typing, it's not helpful. Not in a broken marriage, not in a case like this. In fact, it's hurtful because it gives the Brad in the story some sense of satisfaction that they're actually doing something when they're not. I would actually rather you feel like you're not doing anything so you'll be motivated to do something else that could be helpful. And it also opens up this digital line of communication that the obstinate spouse can use when and if they need to discuss something with you. And that won't be helpful. In other words, if that line of communication wasn't open, when and if they need to speak to you or want to speak to you, and it almost always happens, you have to be very patient, but it happens, then they'll call because you've closed down these digital lines of communication, and you've established a marital culture where you just don't do it digitally. Now, I know, the more time goes on, it used to be I gave this advice and it wasn't such a big deal because who texted anyway? That was in the old days. Now it becomes more and more difficult to adhere to this advice. This is a whole other story, which I'm not going to get deep into, but, many people don't even have real human relationships anymore. The relationship occurs primarily digitally. I predict, by the way, that the younger generation that is really growing up with these devices attached to them and using them in very different ways than we are and do, they're going to have some very serious challenges in their life. I mean, in their primary relationship, in their marriage, very serious. Because they're used to carrying on a relationship digitally, which is great for friends and relatives and sending pictures and chatting and not feeling a sense of loneliness. There's a tremendous irony in that because, the loneliness in our world is increasing, not decreasing. The amount of depression and anxiety and suicide, it's dramatically increasing, not decreasing. So people talk about how these devices are enabling us to all be more connected. The whole world is connected. It's a smaller place. We're all connected. It's a joke, right? Connected is not the word I would use. We might be able to communicate, transmit information quickly and easily to lots of people. That's true. But connect? It's not happening. It's not happening. And these kids are going to be ill-equipped for a marriage because you cannot conduct a marriage digitally. Digital communication is high in efficiency and low in intimacy. And at the end of the day, marriage is all about intimacy. So that's one suggestion I would have for you. Okay, let's go on.
Hi, Mark.
Hey there.
My name is Ben.
Okay, Ben, good evening.
I guess my question is, how much of her personality change and everything is due to the affair she's having?
Well, yeah, well, 99.999999%. let me respond like this. How much of a personality change would you credit to somebody who was on drugs? I mean, you would say things like, they're just not themselves, right?
Right.
You can Google it yourself if you want. There's research showing that what's happening in the brain chemistry when someone's having an affair is comparable to what's happening in the brain chemistry when somebody is doing drugs, namely cocaine. I mean, I'm not exaggerating. It's real research. I once had somebody come on the line and say to me, it was quite a moment, though, I'll never forget it. Somebody once came on the line and said to me, Mort, I was that obstinate spouse having an affair. And you're 1,000% right. The way you describe it is exactly the way it really is. This person was like a rehabilitated drug addict, telling everybody else, the way it is. So I don't know if I would describe it, by the way, as a personality change, but I know what you mean. It's okay. Let's just let that go and not get caught up in semantics. But I know what you mean. It's hard to recognize your wife. She is behaving, very differently. And how much of that is because of the affair? A huge amount of it. Huge. You all, I think, have heard me say before, I'll just review very quickly. I think as difficult and as painful as it is to be betrayed, and as horrible an experience as it is, nobody deserves to be treated that way. I think anybody is nuts for exiting a marriage while their spouse is having an affair. I know it seems strange. What do you mean? She is having an affair. That seems like pretty good justification to exit the marriage. In a sense, I know what one would mean by that, but I see it as the opposite. It's a crazy time to exit a marriage. Why? Because we know that the affair has everything to do with the way they're seeing you and the possibility of marriage with you. And we also know that the affair is going to end. They almost always do. And so put those two together, and what do you have? Well, when the affair ends, they see things very differently. So it's like an affair, as difficult and painful as it is a source of hope in a sense that you almost can be assured that something significant is going to change in your situation within a year. And I think people are mostly foolish for not playing out that opportunity. The situations I get nervous about, the situations that are most difficult, I'm not saying they're impossible, I'm not saying it can't be done, so if this is your situation, I don't want you to get all freaked out, but they are more difficult. And what situations am I referring to? I'm referring to the situations where there is no other man. There is no other woman. And the obstinate spouse is not being bribed in some way, in the way that an affair bribes them. And they're not being impulsive. And they're not, you know, rationalizing. Instead, they have taken a deliberate approach to try to end their marriage. And people who are not being bribed, not in an affair, and who have been somewhat deliberate in their decision-making process, those are difficult situations to heal and reconcile. Again, not impossible. So don't freak out if that's your situation, but they definitely are more difficult. Why? Because it's harder to see what's going to change. It's harder to imagine where the opportunity ahead lies. Now, just because we can't see it and can't imagine it doesn't mean it's not going to happen. I hope you all believe this, and that is that, you know, there are many different partners, so to speak, that are contributing to the to your situation unwinding here. There's you. There's your spouse. There's me. There's any other advisors you may have. There's any other people that may be involved in the marriage, like a mister or a mistress. And then there's one other partner we can never forget, God. In other words, in most situations, something happens that was unpredictable. Something occurs that creates an opening and an opportunity that you could have never seen. You know, that you would have never expected. And so just because I can't see it, like in the case of an affair, it's easy to predict, doesn't mean it's not going to happen. But the fact that it is harder to predict and imagine does make it a more difficult situation, because it's harder to find hope. It's also harder to know exactly what to do. Anyway. Okay, let's go on. Dear Mort, what is your advice to a married couple of almost 25 years with three teens who have had several very difficult years of hurt, resentment, and fighting? One spouse discovered and utilized your course, in addition to other personal growth, counseling, etc., and the fighting has mostly stopped. However, the only changes are in the one spouse's behavior. Being nice, initiating touching and talking, planning date nights, being smarter about avoiding conflict, giving gifts, etc. The other spouse will now agree that the fighting is cut down and things are better, as long as there is no discussion of the past or any hot-button issues, but is not interested in doing any work or making changes themselves, seems to be satisfied with being on the receiving end of the efforts of the other spouse. Is this how it will be forevermore? Or can the working spouse realistically hope for reciprocal care? Can both spouses ever be contented in this situation? Okay. So a few different points that might be helpful. Number one, ask your spouse to do something that you would appreciate. I understand that they may not be reciprocating, in other words, taking initiative. They may not be going through the program and learning what to do and doing it. But it sounds like you unilaterally have made a lot of progress. It sounds like your spouse appreciates the progress in the sense that they're accepting it, they're taking it in, and it has improved the connection, it's created some goodwill, you're succeeding to avoid the conflict. Your spouse is happier in this situation. In these kinds of situations, you've earned the right to ask. And given the situation you've described, I think your spouse is going to find it difficult to say no. In other words, it's not that difficult to not to, I mean, it is, actually, I take that back. It is difficult to not take initiative when a person is giving and loving as much as you described. But he's doing that, okay. But it's more, relatively speaking, it's more difficult to him, for him to maintain that posture when you simply come out and directly ask, would you take me out Saturday night, make some plans for us? Would you rub my feet? Could you please make me a cup of coffee? Would you mind picking my, you know, skirt up at the cleaners tomorrow? Anything. I mean, I'm making up random examples. And look, you may come back to me next month and say, I tried it, and he said no. Okay, I'll go from there. But it's difficult to say no when you're giving and loving in the way that you describe. And my guess is that he won't. That's number one. Number two is that, you know, the mound of guilt by not reciprocating builds and builds and builds and builds and builds. Until eventually, a person can't take it. They can't handle it. They don't feel good about themselves, and they want relief. And so I understand your husband's held out this far. It could be because he's still angry. It could be because he feels that you hurt him, and now it's his turn to hurt you. It could be that he's punishing you, and he feels that you deserve it, and so despite all of your love and giving, he still feels it's justified. But it's very unusual that that go on forever. It doesn't. It's unlikely. You're going to break through. You're going to break through eventually. And there's a number of reasons why you're going to break through eventually. One of them I just described. I'll give you another one. Eventually a person begins to worry that you're going to stop. I mean, I'm sure he's very impressed with your resilience and your endurance, but most people eventually realize that, like, you know, this is not equal. I'm not reciprocating. If I don't at some point begin to give back, she or he is going to run out of steam, and that's not going to be good for me. So that eventually happens as well. And then there are also sometimes moments in a person's life outside of the marriage that make them, that warm them, that make them softer, more sensitive, that arouse them to the sanctity of life, the preciousness of life, the realization that at the end of the day, our life and the quality of it is really dependent upon the quality of our primary relationships. I mean, they're really, you know, I don't know. I sometimes I say this and I feel old when I say it. But, you know, I look around at all the people and all the things that people do to try to, quote, enjoy life. And those things and hobbies and activities and toys and games and devices and cars and features and fashions and it all, like, I mean, you know, it's getting more and more and more and more and more. And like, at some point, I think a person begins to realize that it's not that all that stuff is evil or anything. You know, I just bought a few shirts today. I needed them. But I'm under no illusion that it's going to bring me happiness or any real pleasure. I needed some shirts. But, you know, when my wife and my daughter come to my office tonight to have dinner with me, and I get to spend some time with them. And, you know, my daughter's sitting on my lap, and I see that she wants to be with me, and she loves to be with me, and I was away for a couple of days, and so, you know, I have this teleconference tonight, and my wife is like, you know, I couldn't come home for dinner, so they came here. And it's just like, just, you know, 45 minutes together. And the meaning of those moments with my wife and my daughter, it's like it's just so obvious and clear to me that that is the real value and the meaning of life is in those relationships. And usually there's something that happens in somebody's life that arouses them to that reality. And they start to realize that the pettiness that of the anger and the resentment that they're holding is hurting them more than it's hurting you. And so this gets back to there being various factors in your situation beyond you and your spouse and me. You know, there's also God, and sometimes an event will occur in your spouse's life, has nothing to do with you, but it will arouse them, you know, to the value of you in that relationship. And you just want to keep being you, the great you, the new you. And the more consistent you are, you know, the more likely that you'll be well-positioned for that day. I can't tell you when it'll happen. You don't know. But it'll happen. Okay, let's go on.
Hey, Mark, this is Brad again. I think you didn't quite hear what I was saying. In that emails, it was voicemails that I do send to her. Voice recording.
Oh,
so,
okay.
But then, like I said, since December 10th, I haven't heard a peep from her or nothing, so I don't know if she's spammed me, if she's listening to them.
I would encourage you to keep sending them as well as the gifts and try to save up some of those, some of that weekly income to get a trip down to Florida. That's what I would suggest. And it could be that that's all you can do, until something else breaks.
Hi, Mort. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Thank you. How are you?
Good. This is Brian.
Okay, Brian.
So my question is,
Brian.
So my question, Mort, today is I had one of those wives who was wanted to take control because I was controlling. So we actually got divorced 2 weeks ago. I didn't participate in the process, but my question is, I still have my wedding ring on. And I still love my wife, and I still hope for reconciliation, but do I keep my wedding ring on or take it off?
That's a good question. I don't know that there's a right and wrong answer here. I could see it in two ways. If you wanted to take it off, I don't think you've done anything wrong. I don't think that's ill-advised. I don't think you would have made a mistake. I mean, you know, legally, you're divorced. You're not a married man. A wedding ring generally symbolizes that you're unavailable and married, taken. So, I wouldn't say don't take it off. On the other hand, I have no problem with you keeping it on. And I don't think that would be a mistake. It could be that you're the kind of person who you believe that in the eyes of God you're still married. It could be that, you know, even beyond a faith perspective, that in your heart and in your mind and in your dreams, you're taken. You know, you're committed. Mm-hmm. This is the woman, and this is the relationship that you are still invested in, and yes. And that piece of jewelry, right? I just renamed it, right? To make a point, you know, that piece of jewelry, and that's what it is, symbolizes that for you, has that meaning for you, and I think that's okay also.
Okay.
So I don't really have strong feelings about it. I think so. What, at this point, have you taken it off?
No, it's never come off my hand in for the last 20 years.
And in the, have you seen your wife in the last 2 weeks?
Yeah, I see her almost every day.
Oh, so she knows you haven't taken it off.
Yeah, she knows. Yeah, we have kids
and
together.
Has she said anything about it?
No, she hasn't said a word, but I'm assuming eventually somebody will or she will or somebody. So I just wanted to have a good response because I feel like we are, you know, she's still the love of my life and I hope in my dreams, right? So this piece of jewelry is my commitment still to her.
So I'm really glad you asked the question and I enjoyed, you know, thinking about it. And I hope my responses were helpful, but I hope the main value of my response was it so that you have something to say. In other words, if somebody asks you about it,
mm-hmm.
I wouldn't feel the need, including your wife, by the way, I wouldn't feel the need to, you know, articulate something compelling. Don't feel the need to explain yourself or, you know, to have it make sense. You could just. Every once in a while, I wish it wasn't only audio. I wish it was video. But you could just kind of shrug and, you know, and just kind of in body language indicate that it's just what you want to do and that you, I would be careful about trying to offer some answer or explanation.
That makes sense. It's not a ping pong match.
Let it speak for itself. You know, I mean, the obvious interpretation, I think the obvious interpretation would be what I said, but I think it's more interesting, frankly, and more compelling to anybody who's observing if they just understand it based on the symbol rather than hear it articulated by you.
Very true.
I think that's especially true in the case of your wife. You know, if she felt controlled, now she's, you know, the one who's seizing control. And usually people who feel controlled, they feel that a lot of that control was verbal. They feel kind of overpowered by the one who is dominating. They feel overpowered verbally, intellectually sometimes. So I'm just concerned if you start offering some explanation that she's going to feel that's what's happening.
That's a very good
point. Let it speak for itself. That would be my suggestion. Okay, let's go on.
Hello.
Hi there.
Hi, Moore. My name is Jennifer.
Jennifer, good evening.
Good evening. My question is very similar to the last couple one, except our legal process has only 3 months left. And
only? That's a long time.
Okay. But now every time he wants to talk to me is only about the legal process, and he has settlement agreement draft for my review. So my question is, what do I do besides everything I have been doing on your program? Do I need to change anything?
And no, I'll just remind you of two quick things. I'm going to be quick here because I'm not going to really give anything new. But you want to make sure to continue to employ all the principles and practices that I am teaching. Don't flinch. That's the important thing. The fact that he has served you with papers, that he's asking you to do X, Y, and Z as part of the process, he's going to look for you to kind of roll over because of that. He's going to look for you to accept the fate that he is planning, and that's the last thing you should do. Don't flinch. Don't blink. Don't change anything, assuming that you've been employing all the principles and practice I'm teaching. And secondly, I'm not going to waste time on this either because you've all heard me say this before, but just a reminder, don't participate voluntarily in anything he asks of you in terms of the divorce process. Do anything you're legally compelled to do, but other than that, take a principle-centered stand and make sure he gets that you're a married woman committed to the marriage and to him, and that you won't do anything voluntarily to participate in the divorce process. This is America. You're not trying to control him. You can't control him. He wants to divorce you. He can. But your message to him should be, don't bother asking me to help you, because I can't do it. I won't do it.
Hi, Mort. My name is Ingrid.
Okay, Ingrid. Good evening.
Hi. So I had sent you an email for tonight. My husband coaches football, and I found out in January that he was having an affair with one of the other coaches' wives. And consequently, her husband found out, all of the other coaches, the parents, everyone has found out. So it's gone very public. He is telling me that because of all of the damage that's been done, that he doesn't think we can get past it, and he has no interest or desire to try to get past it. I've been trying to employ all the principles and everything, but he won't do a date night. He won't, you know, do anything like that. I do see him and talk to him every day because of our daughter, and it's actually very amicable when it comes to her. But is there anything else that I could do to try to fix all of this damage that has been done so publicly?
So when you say anything else, there's nothing else based on the description of the situation that you shared with me. I mean, there's nothing particularly unusual about what you shared. I mean, sometimes affairs are public, sometimes they're not. So even that was not particularly unusual. So I guess I don't, you know, I'm not sure I really know what you mean by else. You know, if you mean, you know, beyond what I, you know, generally teach, the answer is no. If you mean, you know, because of what you shared with me, no, there's really nothing, you know, unique about what you shared. Maybe I'll just take the opportunity to remind all of you. I don't think I've given this talk in a while. And it's definitely not new, but on the other hand, it's really an important reminder. I know that what else can I do is like, you know, everyone's favorite question. It's particularly for people who haven't yet achieved the reconciliation that they're looking for. And the reason why that's such a compelling question is because if I've done what you've asked me to do, and I'm still in this situation, so it just seems like a logical question. There must be something else that I'm not doing that I could be doing, and what is it? Now, it's not a foolish question. I mean, it could be that there is something. You know, if I spent more time with any of you, or if David or Mimi or Elise spent more time with any of you, had a chance to really go through in more depth your situation, it could be that we would find something. Yes, you haven't done that in the way you should, and you know, here's what else you should do. Or, that's really unique about your situation, although this is rare, but sometimes that's really unique, and here's what else you should do. But, you know, I'm not pitching sessions for me and David, Elise, and Mimi, because the truth is that while we stand ready to help you for whoever wants to call on us, the truth is that in most situations, the operative question is not what else should I be doing, but it's how much longer should I be doing it? In other words, although it might be logical to assume that if I haven't achieved what I'm trying to achieve, then I must need to do something else. But there's another logic, or maybe it's not logical, it's psychological, that I would ask you to subscribe to, which is that most of the time, the missing ingredient, the missing element, the missing factor or variable is endurance. It's not doing anything else. It's doing what you did yesterday again today and again tomorrow and again on Friday and again and again and again and again. Now, it's not a very sexy answer, right? In other words, one of the reasons why people love to ask that question, what else can I do, is because the freshness or the newness of something else is very exciting. It's very hopeful. Oh, I haven't done that yet. I'll do it. I mean, you would do anything to try to turn this around, right? So you understand the appeal, the psychological appeal to something new. And that's part of where the question comes from. But you have to realize that, you know, it's like the newness or the freshness of anything. You know, a new relationship, right? A new game, a new restaurant, a new car, a new shirt. Like, it's just human psychology. Like, when something is new, it provides a certain level of excitement. But anybody who has any wisdom or life experience knows that real success in anything does not come based on what is new. It comes from being disciplined to do the same thing over and over and over and over again. And it's Aristotle's quote that I've shared with you many times. Excellence is not an act, it's a habit. And it's really true. There's a metaphor used in the Talmud that is of a dripping water that etched out a big mark in a rock. You know, it didn't do it because there was, you know, some special chemical or sauce in the water. It did it because the water kept dripping over and over and over again. And over the many weeks, months, and years, eventually it marked the rock. And you should see your efforts as drips of water and your obstinate spouse as the rock. And you don't need anything new other than the drips of water. You just need to keep dripping over and over and over again. It's not sexy. It's not exciting, but it works. And if you think about it, it's true not just in marriage. I don't know what it is you're good at, but whatever it is, I can almost guarantee you that you've succeeded in it because A, you found the recipe, and B, because you executed that recipe over and over and over and over again. So the operative question really in most situations is not what else should I be doing, it's how much longer should I be doing it. If you had to tell me, if you had to ask me, what is the one variable that best predicts whether or not I will succeed in my healing or reconciliation? I would tell you that one variable, the most important one, there's a lot of important ones, right? And I talk and preach and emphasize a lot of qualities that contribute to the likelihood of you succeeding here. But if you God forbid, held a gun to my head and said, Mort, I want one. What's the most important one? Endurance, tenacity, grit, whatever you want to call it. It's the most important factor. You remember the story of the woman who made dinner for her husband? I know I've told you this story a lot, but it is a compelling one. It's true, and it's a great way to wrap up this point. She made dinner for her husband every single night. And every night she set the table for two. made a nice dinner, put out the plates, the napkins, you know, I don't know, maybe candles sometimes. She sat it at the you know, dining room table. And she sat down to have dinner with him. And every single night, for months, he would pick up the dinner from the table, bring it over to his lazy boy, put the TV on, ignore her, and have dinner. Every single night, for months. Until finally, one day, unexpected, who knows why or how, it's because the drips finally broke through. And he came to the table and said, "Can I join you?" And of course, the tears start streaming down her face. And he sits down. They have dinner together. And that was a turning point. But don't think that she did anything different when she made dinner that night. She didn't do anything different. It wasn't what was on the menu. It wasn't the scent from that night's candle. It was the cumulative result of months and months of love and unconditional kindness. Eventually, that kind of love and unconditional kindness it's very disarming. When it's real, when it's authentic. Okay.
Hello?
Hi there.
Hi, can you hear me okay?
Yeah, loud and clear.
Oh, good. My name's Barbara.
Barbara, good evening.
So, I had a couple of questions, but I think I'm trying to figure out which one's best. Okay, I'm going to ask this one. What can my husband do to help me feel safe that he will protect our marriage from another affair? And I can elaborate.
Is your husband listening to the answer?
No, but he will. He's not here, but he does listen to the Q&As after they're recorded when I send them to him.
Okay, fine. So I'm answering the question. I'm answering his question too. Correct?
Yes and no. It's like
Yeah. So let me just add, have you, the two of you, heard the section in the program, not the plugged-in program, but the previous program, the Marriage Fitness Tele Bootcamp, where I talk about how to rebuild trust, the three pillars of trust?
Yes.
Are you sure?
Absolutely.
Can you tell me what are the three pillars of trust? More importantly, can your husband tell me what the three pillars of trust is? But go ahead.
No. Off the top of my head, no, I can't. It's been a long time.
Your husband should be able to reel these off for me. He should know these upside down and inside out. He needs to listen to that audio file 10 times. And by the way, just a quick summary for everybody. Three pillars of trust are, number one, to be fanatical about being a man or a woman of your word. Number two, to be beyond suspicion. And number three is to be completely transparent. If you want to know what your husband can do to build safety and security, which are just, in my world, synonyms for trust, that's what he can do. When somebody says something to me and they have a long history of always following through with their word, that makes me feel safe. When I see somebody in my relationship with them, they are constantly going out of their way to be beyond suspicion. They're not only interested in doing the right thing, they're concerned about doing the right thing when it might look wrong, so they do it differently so that there's no way it could even be interpreted as wrong. That makes me feel safe. And when somebody is transparent with me, I feel like they're not hiding anything. There's no secrets. That also makes me feel safe, secure, trust. So that whole teaching, I would really encourage the both of you to listen to it again. It's, I don't know, 30 or 45 minutes. It's all about the philosophy of trust, and then it transitions into the three pillars of trust, and that's the answer to your question. I mean, if he really has to be vigilant about adhering mm-hmm. to those three pillars of trust, and if he does that consistently, then it will breed that safety and security that you're asking about.
Okay. Are you still there?
I am.
Oh, okay. I know I'm not supposed to ask another question, and what ifs probably don't matter too much.
It's okay. Go ahead.
He's never really expressed remorse. He doesn't seem to regret. But a lot of things seem really great between us. And so it's really hard to believe that he's not going to allow it. And I know what you're saying.
I'm glad you asked me this. I'm glad you brought this up, and I understand your husband is likely to listen to it. So, yeah, I mean, this was discussed in the program also. This is, you know, one of the steps post-infidelity. It's very important that your husband express that remorse. It's very important that he seek your forgiveness. There's the whole exercise in the program, you know, how to apologize effectively. I mean,
yeah.
If your husband, you know, what's his first name?
Michael.
Michael, you know, if you're going to try, I know it would be nice for you if you could just go on and, you know, have nice times with your wife and move into this new chapter of your life and not have to kind of go back and deal with the pain and the, was there a betrayal, I'm suspecting?
Yeah, 7 to 10 years.
Yeah, it might be, you know, it might be nice for you to not have to go back and have that pride-swallowing experience of expressing remorse, saying sorry, and facing your sins. That might be nice, and maybe that's one of the reasons why you listen to Mort Fertel, because Mort Fertel talks about not speaking about the issues and the problems and moving forward, and, oh, yeah, I love that. We're going to move forward. Okay, that's mm-hmm. true. That is a huge teaching, but go back and listen to it again, Michael. The advice is to temporarily put those problems and issues aside. And that advice applies primarily to your wife, right? I mean, I'm sure it applies to you also. In other words, I'm sure you, Michael, have complaints, things that your wife did that, you know, I'm asking you not to bring up. And it's true, I've been asking her not to bring up the affair and the betrayal and all of that is destructive. Okay, so now you've made progress, you've reconnected, the affair is over, but you've got to return to that issue and help her heal completely from it. You have to return to that betrayal and help her feel, like she's asking me, safe and secure. How could she possibly feel safe and secure that this is not going to happen again if she doesn't have a sense that you think you did anything wrong?
Yeah.
And the only way she can have a sense that you did anything wrong is if you do that how to apologize effectively exercise. Feel her pain. Demonstrate that you understand how she felt. Express remorse. Seek her forgiveness. It's, you know, it's everything we discussed in the program. But yeah, Michael, do it. Do it. It sounds like you've made great progress, and I'm glad about that. And it's and I'm sure a lot of that was because you haven't brought up this pain and this terrible period in your life. Okay, so you know now you're moving into a new chapter. but there's some residue that's left over that you have to return to. You can't run away from it. You can't sweep it under the rug. You can't just say, okay, this is great that we rebuilt this connection, and now I'm just going to never mention this betrayal again. There's some unfinished business here. You've got a nice connection with your wife. Return to that unfinished business and finish it. Now that you have the connection and you've made some progress, you'll be able to do that without it being this really difficult, it'll be difficult, but without it being destructive. It's likely to be productive. There's connection between the two of you. Your wife wants you to do it. You know that she's not going to beat you up. She's not going to take the opportunity when you're vulnerable to hurt you, to punish you. She's dying for you to do it. She's going to open her arm, or she's going to shed tears. She's going to, it's okay for you to do it. Thank you all for your excellent questions. I hope you found my responses helpful. Keep up the good work, and let me know what else I can do to help. Good night, everybody. Thank you.